Greetings. I'm Josh Tyson, co-author of Age of Invisible Machines, the first best-selling book about conversational AI. Age of Invisible Machines explores the learnings of industry veteran and OneReach.ai CEO Rob Wilson. Each week, Rob and I bring in a guest to continue the conversations we started in the pages of our book. This week on the Invisible Machines podcast, we're talking about surprising connections between different cities around the world, why location matters when it comes to forging creativity into innovation, and how organizational AGI might create knowledge-sharing relationships between cities. Our guest is well-known researcher, professor, and author Richard Florida. His books include The Rise of the Creative Class and The New Urban Decay, both of which explore the multi-layered relationships between people and the urban centers where innovation takes hold. Richard is a sought-after speaker, and his strategy firm Creative Class Group works with Meta, Microsoft, WeWork, BMW, Cirque du Soleil, Google, and others. This conversation started rolling right away, so we didn't stop for our customary welcome routine. Let's jump right into this rousing discussion with Richard Florida. Invisible Machines is produced in partnership with OneReach.ai. Their Generative Studio X platform is the only orchestration platform that's been named a leader by every major analyst group. Enterprises and other organizations are already using GSX to create technology ecosystems where they can grow their own digital teammates, called intelligent digital workers. These IDWs can be set to work with hundreds of customizable skills utilizing GSX's no-code building tools. Head to OneReach.ai to test drive an IDW and experience the next phase of generative AI.
I can't say I'm like a huge study of cities, but I'm fascinated by cities as an organism, as a single organism, and how we can learn from them. I'm fascinated what companies can learn from cities. I think one of the things that hit me really early on was the fact that as a comparison, you know, companies come and go and the lifespan of companies are getting shorter and shorter over time, but cities, they survive. They keep going. We think they're dead like Detroit and then they come back stronger. And so what can companies learn from cities? And, you know, is it a centralization, decentralization thing? You know, what is that life that keeps giving? And I also think about cities in like, this city originated because of a railroad.
Yep.
But it's still here. The railroad doesn't matter. and it's still there. It still exists. And you go through like nowhere, you see nothing. And then you come across this town that still exists because of a railroad that doesn't matter as much anymore. I don't know.
So
it's actually
something we know something about, and let me geek out for a minute before we like talk about normal things. So there's a group of people mainly affiliated with the Santa Fe Institute that were fascinated by the question you just asked. Why do cities last so long? And not just railroad towns, what Athens, you know, the centers, you know, Cairo,
right.
The great centers in the Middle East, they're all, now they may have been the most powerful city of their time, but they're still significant world-class cities. And so there's a couple things that they found out. One, this guy Jeffrey West, who's a physicist at Santa Fe, put together maybe 20 or 30 years ago a group of like biologists, physicists, a couple of economists, and they tried to figure out what was the same or different about cities against all other organisms, and that would be firms, organizations, but like biological organisms. And mm-hmm. they came up with this thing they called kind of urban metabolism. And what they found is that all other things that roam the earth, their metabolism gets slower as their size gets bigger. So as you go from an ant to a mouse to a dog to a cow, even to a firm, the only one whose metabolism speeds up is a city. So they call this superlinear, and there's a whole like that I can't even understand, and I'm supposed to have a PhD, but I can't understand what. But basically, the conclusion is that cities are these really unique organisms. And the other thing And I actually worked with another guy. He's like the biggest brain guy I've ever met. His name is Rob Axtell. Rob was a student at Carnegie Mellon when I was there. He was in my class. He knew more social science and social theory than me or anyone else in the class. But when I talked to people like in chemical engineering, he was in some other kind of engineering. They said he built all the climate models. And then when I talked to people in software development, said he built. So anyway, he's become an adaptive agent modeler. He has a huge brain like these Santa Fe people. And he and I, we never published this paper, but he builds these adaptive agent. He actually builds these artificial worlds. We build these adaptive agent models of cities. And what we programmed it, he programmed it, and we said, how do cities grow over all of human history? And this is your question. What that model found is that once a city meets a certain size threshold, I don't know if that was 250,000 people or a million people or some other thing, it very seldom goes away. Like, it can hit. And then when you get big, so imagine this thing going and bubbling and it's forming and all these cities are forming and unforming and they're going around like this. And then all of a sudden it starts to stabilize. And there's these big cities. Let's call them New York and London. Those this shit still keeps going like this. The big ones just stay stable. So what he concluded is once you get to be a city of like 20 million, it's really hard not to dislodge you. That it, yes, you can. And I think you're thinking about Detroit. Like if there was one, or Pittsburgh, right? Two cities I know really well. Like I lived in Pittsburgh 20 years. My wife's from Detroit. If you would have thought two cities could collapse, it would be Pittsburgh and Detroit.
Right.
And somehow they didn't collapse. And actually, now people are going to me like, what has Detroit done right? What has Pittsburgh done right? Anyway, enough of that.
Yeah. There's a relationship with entropy here where, you know, from a physics standpoint, you know, like entropy sort of takes over and the world's, you know, the universe is expanding. But here you have this gravitational pull on cities where entropy, it's the opposite. Centralization keeps happening. It's clustering more and more and more. And it's growing, and so it must have a force, right? Like entropy is that if that's the natural state, then there must be a force that pulls people in. There's a city force of some kind, and I don't know if that was part of that exploration.
No, I think you're right. I think there are two basic forces at work in the geographic world, and most Americans, and I would say this is particularly American affliction. It may be a little Canadian, and it's certainly not European or Asian. Think that the pull forces are predominant. So every time you add a new technology, a subway system, a train, you know, better yet, a car, or the digital world, they immediately say, oh shit, cities will disappear. There's the end of geography, the end of distance, the end of cities. Like this pops up with regularity over the past two or three decades.
Right.
But then there's these pull forces. And I think if you're smart, and I mean, I'm not saying I'm smart, but if you're smart, you realize the pull force is really important. And I think what's so interesting about this is, in the past, the pull force was like fertile soil or natural harbor or lots of raw materials or railroad hub. What people didn't understand until now, and now people go back through all of the historical record and anthropologists and they find this, it's actually the pull forces to be around other people. And Jane Jacobs, you know, this great urbanist figured this out. She said, what cities really are is conglomerations of people. And Robert Lucas, when he got the Nobel Prize, wrote this essay called On the Mechanics of Economic Development. In that essay, he says, no other economist figured this out. This lady named Jane Jacobs figured this out. She didn't have a PhD. She wasn't an economist. What she figured out is he called it a human capital externality. He gave it a name, a formal name, that what economic development is through all of time is talented and creative and innovative people, whether that's a cave drawing or simple language or basic tools, or industrial revolution, it comes when, that's why people come together. When they come together, they make each other more innovative and productive. And I think that's the basic push force that's pushing people in together. And that one seems to be the predominant one because why else would people still go? Why do we have more clustering now? Why does over half the Earth's population live in urban agglomerations? Why do we predict that more than 75% will? If we have digital technology, that has to be the only answer. So I think as we've alleviated the constraints of technology, or technology has alleviated the constraints of the physical world, now we understand more what this thing about clustering is or cities is.
Yeah. So if I, you know, being the scientist, I'm always like, yeah, but then if it's people, what about people? Is it creativity?
I think so. I mean,
is that what it is? Are we creative together? And then we're actually going towards creativity.
No one knows, right? I mean, but I think what we would hypothesize, or what I would argue, is that creativity, we sometimes confuse as an individual genius, and what creativity, as you know, as scientists, we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
You know, Marx, this is the one thing that was really super interesting about Marx. And I use this quote in two or three things. Marx was writing about capitalism and the manufacturing, and he heard this thing where he riffed in the Grundrisse about what would happen in a knowledge society, or when, and he said, nature knows no locomotives, no self-acting mules. And he went on, and he said, those are products of the human mind, of human collective intelligence, of the group social mind objective. But he wrote this in like 1850. I'm like, what the F? So yeah. I think that's what it is, that, you know, there is, it is the collective intelligence or the group or us batting around ideas. And then what happens over time is certain places, and who knows why, certain places get that vibe, right? It may be someplace in the Middle East way back when, and then all of a sudden it's Vienna or Rome or London or Budapest or New York or wherever it is. It moves. That zeitgeist moves. And I think in the current environment, that cool place or vibe or whatever it is attracts other people to it. So then you go, oh, that's a place I should be, and you go to it. So yeah, I think it is this social, this group process of working together. And that could be on physical things, it could be on manufacturing, it could be on widgets, it could be on arts. You know, and I don't think it's all collaboration. I think some of it's like, if you ask Steve Jobs or Jack White, what made Silicon Valley great? What made a great music scene? They say the same thing. It's people coming there to compete and collaborate. What Jack White said was, out of that process, like there's musicians and artists and designers and bands and drummers, and we're all combined, and Steve Jobs said, we're all combining and recombining, right? I found a new drummer, you found a new guitar player, and we're competing. And out of that, one or two hit, right? Not all of them hit. One or two venture capitalist startups become successful. One or two bands become successful. So I don't think it's all like holding hands and singing Kumbaya. I think there's a lot of competition there and a lot of combination and recombination, a lot of bets, and something pops and makes that place the center.
So it's sort of mathematics, which is what makes sense. It's iteration. We often say in our space that great design, great experiences, conversational or graphical design comes from iteration. And rapid iteration, to your point, is recombining, creating those algorithms over and over again, and then measuring the results. And if that is rapid, which it is in cities when you have that density of people, then it's just an odds game that says you've iterated, just like an experiment, the more you iterate, the faster you get to a result. Doesn't mean you can't end up getting lucky in a rural environment and have a brother that you know, Jonas Brothers or whatever. I don't know
That's
if
exactly
they grew up in a rural environment, but but the mathematics say more often that iteration is going to happen in that dense
and
environment.
Other research, like including guys I work with at the University of Toronto, now you can get data on people's skills. It comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it tells you not only what job they do, but like, and there's 800 like skills, but they can group them into mental, cognitive skills, physical skills, like, you know, bending metal or cutting hair, or like social. I don't have a really good word for social skills, but it's not like, it's like entrepreneurship. It's like putting things together in a new way, like managing and leading. But it's not like social skills, like I want to have a nice classroom. It's really like those entrepreneurial, building a new team, getting something new started. And what they find is that the physical skills are fairly ubiquitously distributed. Okay. Knowledge skills concentrate in bigger cities, but the skill that really concentrates in big city is this social, transformational, leadership, entrepreneurial skill. And I think another way of saying that, you have to have people who can translate an idea into a market or translate something into a heuristic, and then iterate like crazy. Cities seem to be the places these kind of people go. Like in the venture world, they call them serial entrepreneurs. You know, in the music world, you'd call them hit makers. I don't know what there are people who can make sense out of shit that most other people can't. They're like, they're taking something and learning it from an incoherent to heuristic. That kind of skill seems to be the one that gravitates the most to density or is propagated most in density.
It almost feels like there's like an evolutionary aspect to it. We had this cool conversation with Blaise Aguirre-Yarkas, who's a VP at Google, and he was talking a lot about collective intelligence,
Yeah.
And also like the islanding effect where small populations that are isolated from that, I guess probably that ability to iterate, they stall out. Like they fail to innovate. And so, you know, that seems like a death sentence. Yeah, in a rapidly changing world. And he talked a bit too about how, we credit Thomas Edison with inventing the light bulb, but really, I think he said there were like 12 virtually identical or very similar inventions happening around the same time. So there's also this element of, again, of like collective intelligence of people figuring out the same things around the same time.
It all sounds different. And then you go back 10 years later and you listen to it and all the bands sound the same. Like what sounded so different then at all, you realize that they're all iterating around and competing around this same thematic, same thing with art movements, right? Uh-huh. And I think how you mobilize collective intelligence, and for a place like Google, I mean, what's so interesting, I don't know anything about Google, except they asked me to give a talk about a book that I wrote called Who's Your City? And in that talk, I kind of said, it's really interesting that you guys chose to go to New York. And they're like, yeah, well, we did a survey. And it said that a lot of people who work with Google wanted to be in a big, like, we didn't know that, wanted to be in a, they didn't, like, Silicon Valley is great. It's the center of the universe. But if you looked at where many of our people wanted to be, other than that, it was New York. And then I said something like, wouldn't it be interesting to know where the people at Google live and work in New York? And they, like, pulled up the laptop and they just showed me. Like, here's where we live. And it's not in the suburbs. It's all around this center of excitement. So, yeah, I think that that companies like Google have tried to figure that out. I think what's so interesting is, I mean, I actually do work on this. Corporations don't think long enough about location. What we have is a bunch, and Google, I think, is different. Most corporations look at the map like a chessboard and go, oh, I'll place my factory here because the workers won't join a union or costs are low, or I'll shut down all my offices because I want to make money on real estate, and they outsource that to consultants. But actually, this idea of spatial strategy, like where you put shit to dip into those pockets, is non-trivial. And if any company does it, I don't know, it's Google, but I would tell you 99% of companies don't pay any attention to this. They just plop shit down. And right now they're like, let's close all our offices. And you could get a lot of, the guy who hired me, Roger Martin, who's a corporate strategist, I said, why are you hiring an urbanist to be in a business school? And he's like, well, Michael Porter created this field called competitive strategy and corporate strategy. And they look at all the internal conditions of companies that make for an effective corporate strategy, demand, you know, blah, blah, blah. He said, what you're talking about is this other category called jurisdictional advantage. The location you're in confers advantage. And then, well, like, holy shit, that's right. So, yeah, I think that there's this symbiosis between the corporate entity and a local thing, but no one has tapped into that. I mean,
it'd be interesting if you could measure iteration of ideas, right? It would be interesting to see how it changes when you do get to a remote workforce. Does that slow down considerably, which means the creativity and, like, if creativity is a force, right, it's a flow, it's not a thing, then you're like, wow, this company's creativity is slowed down because their iteration slowed down because they're not, the density's down. But I know it's not just density, right? There's diversity, because otherwise you could end up with these, and I know you talk a lot about this, you get these homogeneous communities that are dense, but they're not diverse. And so you lose creativity on the fact that it's an echo chamber of folks. You don't get the creativity gets kind of drawn out of the city, but it's really just the different diversity of creativity.
And, you know, my students in the University of Toronto, I forget when this was. I started in 2007. So some point early in my career, my students were already predicting the death of BlackBerry at a time. And these are the kids in my MBA class, and they're saying exactly what you said. They said that Waterloo is great, but it's an echo chamber, and it's an echo chamber of basically hardware geeks. They don't have the richness of a San Francisco or a New York and a diversity of ideas that will push them on this idea. I didn't even know what they were talking about. User interface, the thing that they saw on an iPhone. They're like, no, that can't happen in Waterloo. And I'm sure other people saw it. In retrospect, they were spot on right. And I think the other thing that happens in great cities, they're dense, so collisions happen. They're diverse, so there's many. And I think if you take ethnic diversity or sexual preference diversity, that also reflects a diversity of thinking styles. I think those are they go together. But the other thing is that I think great cities are pretty meritocratic. Like, a shitty city is, like, not only insular, it's nepotistic. A great, like, one thing about New York or London or San Francisco, you can complain all you want about, but they know how to value talent. Or L.A. They know how to value. Now, we might not like how they do it, but man, they can mobilize talent in a way that a smaller city can't. It's like, do I know his brother? What high school did they go? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And I think that great cities are at a certain talent identification and talent utilization machines, and as well as being diverse in their thinking style and dense in their collisions.
Yeah, that kind of brings up something we wanted to talk about. Josh and I were talking about this before, and it's something that's coming up more and more in our conversations, which is like network effect.
Yeah.
And it's this idea for companies that get momentum, you know, they sort of startups struggle, and then the ones that get that network effect get this momentum that are almost successful in spite of themselves, right? A network effect, you know, probably is incredibly obvious when you look at cities, because somebody moves to a city because somebody they know or a family member lives there, you know, there's a massive sort of a network effect component of it. And now, you know, that's sort of the outer edge. Like, what is that effect? Creativity and ideas and iteration. But this network effect seems to be key to success of cities, success of companies. What I'm interested in thinking about is the virtual city, like the Facebook, which is like, now we're talking about cities bigger than any other city.
Yep.
Any physical city, right? And going like, this is the virtual version of a city, but it's not a city, right? But we do have this, some of these ingredients of iteration, like people are posting and liking, and now we're getting like, in some ways, massive iteration, but not the same flavor and the echo chambers, because we now surround ourselves with intentionally, like, isolate us from diversity.
So I actually have been working on this. So, you know, I'm just a very lucky person that I sit at the middle of all these networks, and I typically don't work with other social scientists. I learn a lot from scientists, and now I just met these people at BCG, Boston Consulting Group. So, and they have a big internal network of practitioners. So we wrote two things for Harvard Business Review, which may be of interest to folks listening. The first one was on the metaverse in cities. So we actually, and I actually have a big project funded by Meta in the creator economy. So we're surveying, we've just completed a survey of creators all across, the first one ever, real one ever done. So I don't know a lot about it. And the reason the Meta people said to me, you said, you wrote a book on the creative class. Well, you should know, I like, what is the creator economy? I had no idea what they're talking about. These digital online people who, you know, are influencers and celebrities and people who build online games and blah, blah, blah. So the first thing we did was try to unpack it. And what we said in the first paper, or first essay, was rather than thinking about the metaverse and the city as opposites, think of them as where they nest. And for companies, they need to be both present in the metaverse and present in cities. And the cities that will be the most successful will actually work as portals. They'll be the physical embodiment. And then in the second one that we just published, called The Rise of the Meta City, I think this is a really interesting, if almost the first one just got our wheels thinking. The second one said a new kind of city is emerging. For all of human history, cities were physical artifacts. Everything co-located. First, work and life were together in the same place on a farm. And then it separated a little between, and then we got a factory and an office. And we broke this apart, but it was all physically co-located. And in fact, when you look at the definition of a metropolitan area, it's a commuting zone. That's, if you read academic papers, they either use the word metropolitan area or commuting zone. That's what they mean when they say a city, a place that people commute from where they live to where they work. For the first time, these digital technologies have allowed us to have a physical entity with digital networks. So the city no longer is just a physical thing. It has digital peripheries, right? So what we did in this thing was literally look at what cities sit at the center of these networks. And at the top of it were New York and London. but the next cities were super fascinating. It wasn't like Tokyo, Hong Kong, Paris, Berlin, and Frankfurt. It was Singapore, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi. And then you thought about it and you go, oh shit. Singapore, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, big airports, lots of hotels, lots of, and then in the next tier were like Miami and Las Vegas. And what we began to do was think about now pairs of cities. And just, to, I'll make this short. What we began to say is it's wrong to think of San Francisco versus Austin or Miami versus New York or Nashville against LA. When we looked at the data, what we saw is that Austin is basically a suburb of San Francisco. Miami, it's called the Sixth Borough, is basically a suburb of New York financial industry. And Nashville is intrinsically connected to Los Angeles. So it's for the first time, you can have distant peripheries, which aren't suburbs. So it's there's a, I think what I'm trying to say is there's a structure to this new kind of city, which is physical and digital. It's not just the rise of all these points on a map. There's a network structure to the nature of the city system. And I think that's something that people need to pay a lot more attention to.
Well, and like the hybrid work environment becoming more entrenched. Now, yep. Now you can see the rise of something like the Nashville, Los Angeles metropolitan area, which is really fascinating. As we see like the technology associated with AI kind of starting to augment hybrid work environments,
yep.
What direction do you think that pushes the meta city? Does it make it even more close, like closer to what we were talking about a minute ago, like where it's there is such a heavy virtual component that almost becomes its own entity, or is there some sort of integrated version of everything?
So I think that is, it reinforces the meta city. It means that thinking about Miami as a challenger or as a new financial center is dumb. Thinking of Miami in relation to New York is smart. Thinking, in fact, we also say this, you may be a superstar city like London and New York. You may actually lose population and see your power, your economic power and centrality of the network increase. So you might get these cities, which are cities of super connection, you know, where all the connections go, like they're like the switchboard. And I think if you're a smaller city, you got to figure out how to plug into the switchboard. If you're a big city, you figure out how to be the switchboard. And I think if you're a corporation, you need a locational or spatial strategy. Like, then you start to think, okay, I'm not just going to have my remote workers anywhere. Of course. But I can start to manage a little bit. What are the remote locations that make the most sense? And in which of those locations should I create satellite units? Which of those locations should I create satellite centers? So yeah, but I think what we're trying to figure out is there's a structure. In geography terms, geographers have always had a concept for this, but it was different. It's called the spatial division of labor. It's like once there's a, you know, there was like inputs that came from the ground, and then there was a manufacturing plant and suppliers in a spatial division. But in the knowledge economy, that spatial division of remote work is really different. And I think if you're a human, you should think long and hard about that, because you probably don't want to locate yourself out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You probably want to, like, if you're in the entertainment industry, Nashville makes sense. If you're in the finance industry, Miami makes sense. Like, I'm talking to you from Miami Beach. We have a winter place here. There's very little, I mean, I know Keith Raboy and other people talk about but I hear very little of this in my daily life. What I hear about is I have to go to New York tomorrow from people in finance and real estate. And if I don't like my job that I'm doing remotely from Miami, I might have to move back to New York because that's where the jobs are. And I'm trying to figure out, because I like Miami, how do I stay here but have a job in New York? And you see the same conversation in Nashville about LA. You see the same conversation in Austin about San Francisco. So I think, I don't want to call them match pairs. There's hubs and satellites. And if you're a human, if you're in finance, you're in a lot stronger position, I think, being in Miami than being in Bozeman. I like Bozeman. But if you're in academia, there are other places for you to be. So anyway, I think there's a structure to the network that people need to pay attention to.
This brings up something I wanted to talk to you about. So I spent a lot of time in Europe, and I was sort of fascinated by like the fact that people were in the parks. That, you know, coming from Denver, I spent some time in Denver, like the parks were empty.
Yep.
And then you see all these people in the parks, and you see young people, like just diversity, right? And it occurred to me that none of these things are simple, but there's always multiple components that drive it. But one of the drivers were these two teenagers are sitting on a bench, and you just know that they live in a small apartment with their parents and their grandparents, and this was the only way they could be alone, right? Like they were sort of, in a way, the diversity that they were experiencing in the park, they were driven to it. They weren't seeking out diversity. And it feels like when we go online, we don't seek out diversity. We seek out all the people that agree with us, right? And we seek out this echo chamber. And it almost feels like in order to get diversity, there has to be this force function, something that forces us, because it's uncomfortable. Like, diverse gets comfortable to be in a room with everyone who's like us and agrees with us. So it feels like there's like this force function that happens in cities and in the physical space, because the more you can't afford an apartment, the more they subdivide the apartment and it gets smaller, and the smaller it gets, the more you go outside and then you get forced. But online, you're never forced. That diversity is, now you get to find the subset of the subset of the subset of the group of people that agree with everything you say, and create your own little city and pick your neighbors. And that like mini echo chamber feels like dangerous. And you go, what is the force function online? Is it just getting offline? Is that just simply it? What is the force function that's going to like balance back this diversity that we need apparently for our creativity to thrive?
I don't know, but I'll echo what you said. I still remember taking our two kids who were 6 and 8, so maybe they were 5 and 7 at the time, something like that, to Paris, and deciding we wanted to walk to show them things like the Eiffel Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to stop and play in the parks with the other kids. And the parks were I'm like, we have to get to the Eiffel Tower someday today, guys. Every, few blocks, there was another park filled with kids. And then I remember out of the corner of my eye, I watched a basketball game and thought, oh, it's going to be stupid because I'm an American. And there were these French guys and obviously African guys, it looked like it was at Rucker Park in New York City. I mean, they were flying through the air and dunking and passing. I'm like, oh shit. The diversity here in these public spaces, and no, in the U.S., aside from New York City, everyone has their own privatized, and not only their privatized backyard, but with the pandemic, their privatized office, their kids' playroom, the basement, like, I call it, you've heard this comment, the thing about the 15-minute city. The 15-minute city was invented by this guy, Carlos Moreno, who's advising the mayor of Paris, that said, what we should do in the modern world is have no longer these long commutes, but have each neighborhood a self-contained 15-minute city. And it's a great idea. I said, in America, we're building one-minute cities called a McMansion. Right? And you live in your one-minute city, and you call Uber Eats or whatever it is,
right,
or Dash. You get your food delivered. You never leave. You have your Peloton bike. You have your exercise studio. I'm like, that's to me is hemp. So
right.
I think what's really interesting to me, the U.S. is doing this experiment, aside from New York and maybe a few other places, in can we live an online life in a digital world, and we're congratulating ourselves and saying what remote work is doing is letting people move further and further away, whereas in other societies, they're not doing that experiment. So I think what other societies have done, great cities, are these cities that because you have, just like you said, you have small space, another place to see it is NYU. You look at most universities in the United States and Canada, and very few people are back in the office. NYU is like, everybody's in their office. Why? Because they all have a little apartment, right? It's an NYU subsidized apartment, and it's tiny. You have a family of four, you have a two-bedroom apartment, one bathroom, and you're all over one another. And then everybody either has to go to the park or they have to go to the office. So yeah, I think this idea of constraint, and particularly space constraint, for innovation and creativity, it's a good thing.
Yeah. It feels like it's like diversity has to be forced upon us. We're not going to seek it out. It seems like we're just too comfortable. And maybe it's a evolutionary thing. We're too comfortable and feel too safe in environments that all agree with us and look like us. And that something has to like push us towards diversity. And online, there's no force function. There's nothing that drives. We can get the news that feeds our narrative and makes us feel Like,
but what if there's a demographic component? I'm just thinking about this. Like, why does the U.S. stay so innovative? Why does it do so many interesting things with this stretched out, highly privatized way of life and spatial structure?
Right.
And what came
interesting
to mind
question.
Is all really ambitious young people I know want to move to New York. A few want to go to San Francisco, and some in entertainment want to go to L.A. They don't want to go anywhere. Maybe a handful want to go to London. That's it. But, you know, you talk to young people now, I want to go to New York. I want, whether they do finance, real estate, technology, arts. Maybe New York is that churning thing in the U.S. And then when people hit a certain age that they want to have a family, they just go everywhere else. And New York keeps churning and churning these young, crazy, rambunctious people with lots of skill and lots of ability and lots of energy. And then the people who go off further away are people like I hate to say our age, but you know what I'm saying.
Like, yeah.
You know, we have, when I met Peter Jackson a long time ago, he said, when I was young Peter Jackson, I had to go to LA. There was no way I could be this Peter Jackson in Wellington, New Zealand. But now that I'm old Peter Jackson, he wasn't even that old, I can live in Wellington because I have a network in LA and I'm established and I know what to do. I just wonder if you can survive as a society with one of these things, or two of these things, or three of these things, and the rest of it can all fly apart, and it doesn't really matter as long as you have the New York. And so I don't. What I'm trying to say is I don't want to write off the United States, because in many ways the United States looks wrong on all of this. Paris or London or Europe and Asia look right on this, but the U.S. still remains super innovative, and maybe because the U.S. has it for the innovative component, and then everybody else gets the less diverse.
Yeah.
Maybe the key is like bringing in what Rob was talking about, some sort of force function, because like I have some good friends I can think about who I've known since we were in high school. They both work in technology, and I would have assumed that they would definitely live in like as big a city as possible. And for a while they did. They were in LA and stuff.
Yep.
And then, you know, they moved to Denver, and I considered that for them kind of like stepping down a bit. But now they've moved to these small mountain towns. And I wonder, like, I feel like when I talk to them now, I can tell that some of that energy is missing. So I wonder if like the hybrid work environment might actually be our best shot at injecting diversity into the lives of people who are kind of isolated and remote, right?
The other thing that I just wanted to throw in here that we glossed over, if I look at American creative history, and I don't know how to square this, there is a very strong urban part of that, New York and the Village in the 20s and all. But even if you look at the American arts, American music, American popular music, a lot of it happens in rural areas. And the one I always come back, it's not just California, it's Woodstock. I mean, that Woodstock Festival happened because there were so many musicians like Bob Dylan and the band and so many artists that had already moved to, now, Woodstock is close to New York City, that he said, can I put a music studio out there? And the guy who was going to build a music studio said, well, why don't we do a festival? I don't want to discount, you know, that there's some isolating elements about being, but there is also some, if you listen to the guys in the band, why they created that music, they would say because they removed themselves. Does that make sense? They were close to New York City, but also removed. So maybe there's a yin and yang here, that certain times you need to be immersed in the hubbub, and other times you need to be pulled back, and maybe it's the relationship between the two other than the one versus the other. It's just
maybe too. It's like if you kind of come into sort of a special, unique creative symbiosis with other people, right? Like it would make sense that the band, who are communicating to each other on these like insane levels, not using regular language, they could go live out in the middle of nowhere and be creative for a lifetime probably, but it's a little harder.
Or even for just 4 years.
Yeah.
Like, it might be that certain times you need that crazy energy of the urban center. And then at certain times, and I think you're right, Josh, not as an individual, maybe if you have a team, a band, there's four or five of you, and you're riffing off one another, putting the noise at bay, leaving LA and going to Malibu, leaving New York and going to whatever. Yes, and we know this in many great albums. Wasn't just that one. Many great albums are somebody rents a house in the middle of fucking France. I'm just suggesting maybe there's a yin and yang, and maybe the remote world, the hybrid world, gives you a little bit more opportunity to get the best of both or to make that interplay a little bit more effective.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if, like, thinking about AI as being a better decision maker than us at complex problems that require a lot of data. I think about creating a community as a complex problem. What if, and we see this now, the artificial intelligence component of it, or the complexity, is put up to machines and they design our online communities for us with diversity in mind, right? Instead of us designing, and you can sort of see it happening as people suggest friends, or they suggest people you should connect with that you don't know. We sort of see a very early beginning of it, except that the algorithms that define who your friend should be, or those suggestions, are written by people and they're very deterministic. But if you really let AI into the mix and you're saying, look, like, this is going to introduce people from a diversity standpoint that isn't designed by a human, it's going to do it based on data. You know, does that start to possibly move us away from these echo chamber, you know, communities into more diversity? And that is the nice thing about online, is in the physical world, if you lack diversity, it takes time to bring that back in. It takes a lot of effort. And you talk about that, like, what can cities do to bring creativity back? It's heavy, but online it's faster.
For sure. And, you know, I wonder too, if I think about the birth of AI, or I think about the birth of modern computing, modern semiconductor, all the things that are going to modern electronics, digital world. The founders of that thought that the technology was a product of a community. You know, they all, if you go read that book, Fire in the Valley, about the history of Silicon Valley, and you really read about Stuart Brand and, you know, Jobs and Wozniak, they were part of this incredible community. They were kind of hippies. They were part of this ethos of doing something new. The technology was coming, and now it almost seems like the technology is viewed as a supplanting of community. Like, there's a new generation of companies and technologists and entrepreneurs that are just saying, why do we even need these things called communities anymore? And we have the technologies. I wonder if that happens as a, you know, that you could almost see how Detroit was the same thing with cars. All these people knew they needed Detroit when they were working on bicycles and bicycle, you know, horse-drawn carriages and trying to figure out how to hook up an engine. Then all of a sudden they said, no, we don't need this. We can put those factories anywhere. I wonder if that becomes part of the death knell or death rattle of a form. I don't know. But it seems like that the two should go together, not apart. And too much in our society now, we think of technology and artificial intelligence as supplanting community, as
versus,
instead of saying
versus
artificial intelligence,
enabling
the world connected to community.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. We're going to see. The next 10 years will tell us.
Yeah, I think we're big fans of the idea of AIs facilitating connectivity between humans versus artificially supplanting it, as you said. That's the exciting idea behind it, is can it enhance and maybe create more connectivity?
Well, certainly this is good, right? Like, let's just make it, what we're doing, we couldn't have done even with a phone. And this is still pretty primitive. Like, we're riffing pretty good, and we're creating the seeds of new ideas. So there's no doubt that it can be done. I don't know if you can create a creative constellation in it. You may be able to create certain one-offs, but maybe to create a creative constellation, we should be co-located or should be in the same place. Maybe we can do that by meeting regularly. I don't know. But it's not going to reproduce itself. It's not going to create this incredible flywheel. And, you know, as much as the technology people who created San Francisco bitch about San Francisco, I think it is more dominant in artificial intelligence than any other previous technology I can think of off the top of my mind. So, yeah people are saying it's not important. We're going to be in the cloud. It's all going to go away. We're going to move away. But yet 50% of those AI startups, and who knows what of the important ones, are located in the San Francisco Bay Area. So even though they think it's going to, it doesn't seem to. So maybe there is something in the co-location and the flywheel that enables it to keep reproducing, while this can do certain one-offs great.
Yeah, you talk about the Industrial Revolution being like more impactful to cities than COVID or almost anything really, right? Like a major, and I think, you know, this idea that factories move away and leave empty places that we fill with, you know, offices, and now we have offices beginning to go away to be filled with what? What will those offices be filled with?
So I think Detroit, I mean, look, this is my favorite story on this is, you know, I go to Detroit all the time. I love Detroit. It's real. It's just like my kind of city, right? It's just what I would like. And for years, they were not following my advice. Not that I mean, they were saying, what are we going to fill up Detroit with? Stadiums, arenas, and casinos. And I was like, no, that's not the way you build a city. And I go, last fall, and I give a talk to the U.S. Travel Association. And the CEOs of the U.S., you know, these are all the big travel companies and credit card companies. And they're like, Richard, what can we tell San Francisco? What can we tell San Francisco that we learned from Detroit? I'm like, hold on. I'm now having a mind melt. Like, Detroit was supposed to be the place that was declining, and San Francisco was the future. And you're, and then it dawned on me what Detroit did was the right decision. That what we now know since then is that about, if you look at what happens in downtown, about 25% of it is office work, physical activity. About 10 to 15% is people who live there, and the rest, 60%, is visitors. Downtowns are places, local and international, tourists go and visitors go, and they grab dinner and they dine out and they watch a game and they go to arena. And Detroit, because it had no choice, the suburbs were too far out, the factories were all closed. I don't want to say it figured that out. It just did what it had to do. It put a baseball stadium, a football stadium, a basketball and a hockey arena, and started like building a few offices, but not a lot, and some nightlife and restaurants. And now people love going down there. And in fact, I just looked at a survey. I got the data from Gensler. In North America, when they ask residents, like, how do you value your downtown as a place to work, live, shop, dine out, discover new things, Detroit was in the top five. So even though most of those people live in the suburbs, they still valued their downtown. So I think what goes there increasingly is entertainment and connectivity. And the other thing we know is that even people don't like to go to the office, like to go downtown, not just to have fun, but to have dinner or to meet with their friends. So they want a co-working space downtown. They want to go to a restaurant. So downtown seems to me like, I don't want to call it a marketplace. It's the place that you would go to get entertainment, get culture, meet friends, go to dinner. And that's the best place to do that.
Yeah, so maybe that force function, remote work is a force function. If we sit in our offices, in our houses all day, we got to get out. And it forces us to go into the city. And maybe that forcing function now is being recreated through remote work.
I think that's
because we're not in an office with a bunch of people and we need that. So now it's driving us to be there in restaurants and meet with friends. And maybe it's the people we choose versus the people that were randomly selected, you know, in the office that we're sort of surrounded with. Again, echo chamber balance challenges. Well, one question I have for you is, does city planning work?
No.
I mean, does it work?
No, and Jane Jacobs, you know, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. Yeah, this is so amazing. You know, here is a woman who doesn't have a, I'm not the chip. She's a woman from Scranton who moves to New York City, decides she wants to become an architectural writer and starts using her eyes to look around. And she writes the most amazing essay in the 1950s, which becomes this book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and then her most important book, The Economy of Cities. And in that essay, though, she's looking at downtowns and going, these downtowns, Midtown, is destroyed. Like, Midtown, and the title of that essay, this essay is written before I was born. I'm born in 1957. Title of that essay is called Downtown is for People. Downtown is for People. And her point was that the city planners and the government bureaucrats and the people tearing down neighborhoods and putting in freeways and putting in these giant plazas with tall buildings were deadening the space. She was looking at Greenwich Village, where she lived, this hubbub of industrial uses in Soho and factories and, you know, the meatpacking district close by and all these ethnic spots and like she's going, no, this is a real neighborhood with a park like Washington Square Park where people were demonstrating and playing folk music. So, yeah, I think city, if you think about it, what is city planning? It comes out of the Industrial Revolution as a way to segregate land uses to keep the dirty, smelly factories away from the upscale retail and residential districts. And so city planning has a use. I have a PhD in city planning. But in general, the idea that you can plan cities misses what they are. They're organic developments. And then if you look more recently, the imposition of all these rules and regulations about what you can build where and how much building codes and zoning ordinance mean we haven't built enough housing. It's called the NIMBY, you know, moving from a NIMBY, not in my backyard, to a YIMBY, yes, in my backyard. So I think that we need to move away from what we think of as city planning.
And maybe city planning breaks it. I wonder if then we need to move away from planning companies. I wonder if that sort of planning doesn't work for cities, is it the same for companies in that, you know, you can't control these things. You need it to be organic. You need it to emerge. You need people to be people. You need them to cluster and iterate.
So I think companies, look, if I think of, now I teach in a business school, so I've all learned this from being in a business school. There is this field of corporate strategy which has supplanted corporate planning. And corporate strategy and management is often about decentralization, disaggregation. I mean, Ram Jaikumar wrote a thing a long time ago which said Americans were too top-heavy, too top-down. You need to empower the factory floor, and there should be strategists on top looking at the future. We don't have any of that in urban affairs. It's all top-down, bureaucratic. And for the life of me, I tried to promote this idea of locational strategy, spatial strategy. And it's been really hard. We even tried to build a school of cities at the University of Toronto. And, you know, my argument was when we created this new field called engineering, we created engineering schools. When we created modern medicine, science-based, they built Johns Hopkins University Medical School and linked science to clinical practice and teaching hospitals, business schools, law schools. We don't have the same thing for cities, but it's really hard to get cities, maybe because they're so big, they're so diverse, they have so many constituencies. It is very hard to create a discipline or a way of thinking about cities that's integrated. I've tried for the past 20 years, and it's not something I could get off the ground. So I think it will happen, but it's been way harder than I thought it would be.
So maybe we're too dumb to design cities, and we're too dumb to design companies because
we tend
to cluster things. We lose diversity because we like to categorize. This area will be for manufacturing, and this area will be for schools, and the two won't meet. Like, keep your peas out of your mashed potatoes, but then you lose that creativity. But maybe AI changes that. Maybe.
It's a lot easier to start a company than it is to start a city. That's the one, you know, a startup, the Schumpeterian startup can be created and is created. It's near impossible. So you're dealing with things which is much more incumbent and inert.
True.
I think you're right about technology. This is where technology provides.
Yeah, true. It takes two people to start one person to start a company, but one person does not start a city. But that network effect still matters because those companies tend not to survive unless they hit that point of inflection on the network effect. Which is, I guess, what every city eventually, you know, some hit it, some don't. They become big. I'm still fascinated with what is that? What is that network effect? What is it that, is it immigration? Like, is that the,
I think there's two things. I think new entrants, low barriers to entry. That's something I said in that. Low barriers to entry really matter. And the difference between San Francisco and Austin or Denver and Pittsburgh is Pittsburgh had really high barriers to entry. It was just a hard place to enter and become someone. Whereas in New York, there are low barriers to entry. I think the other thing, Tim Cutler, you know, who was this thinker and writer, is now a venture capitalist. I think she wrote this in a tweet. She may have in an essay that supported it. She said, of all organisms, the hardest one to scale is a city. And when you think about it, you know, it's easy to build, with current technology, it's relatively easy to build a human settlement of about 1 to 3 million people. You build roads, you build single family homes, you have a little bit of a multifamily district. Once you get over 5, 6, 7 million, now you have to start building high rises, you have to start building transit. The scaling function changes. So I think there is a reason there's not so many New Yorks and Londons and Singapore's and Tokyo's. It's hard. I think that cities then, go back to the first thing we talked about. If cities are the one thing that the metabolism increases, there are things like traffic congestion that will start to slow the metabolism. So you need to start to alleviate constraints. You need to have density that allows people to be together in neighborhoods and walk to things because they can't get there from far in a car. Creating that right scaling is really hard. And I think that's why it's hard to build one from scratch. And I think maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is being done in Asia and the Middle East, but certainly in North America, once the car enters the equation after the war, hard to see you getting to a city that can really, all the cities that seem to scale are pre-war.
We on this podcast get into the area of like artificial general intelligence. And we've been talking a lot lately about this idea of kind of organizational artificial general intelligence, because we're working with companies that are kind of creating technology ecosystems where, you know, legacy software and data are all connected and people can just kind of communicate with it. And the idea being that eventually that system develops an awareness of the company that allows it to predict future outcomes and things like that. It essentially becomes self-aware to a degree. And then, you know, we had a conversation with Ben Goertzel, who kind of coined the term singularity. And he talks a lot about kind of how actual AGI is likely to be decentralized. So it seems like possible that these individual organizations that have kind of reached this self-awareness state, not only will they most likely, the ones who get there first are probably going to dominate their industry, but they'll also be communicating with other adjacent companies that perhaps have reached that state too. And in the case of like, you know, the New York, Miami metropolitan area, if there are like banking giants that have these self-aware systems in place that are now communicating, does that metropolitan area also become now a hub of this of supreme intelligence, I guess, for lack of a less freaky term?
The best place to tap into that would be not only in the company, but outside the company in the jurisdiction it's where it's located. And I'm giving a speech in the next couple of months, and I just talked to the folks supporting that speech. It's something like, it's in South Carolina, a small town in South Carolina, and it's Michelin Innovation Institute. I'm not that exactly it. And when I talk to them, what they are is a group of small communities spearheaded by Michelin's headquarters, which is not Paris, which is a relatively small community in France. Communities all over Europe, all over North America, and all over Asia, which Michelin has organized to learn from one another, to share best practice, to communicate with one another. Talk about not just where you put a rubber and tire factory. Of course, you talk about where. They have a whole section on incubation, startups, innovation, sustainability. I talked to a friend of mine who was the Latin American and North American CEO of Colgate. I'm like, holy fuck. Have you ever heard of anything like this? So the company has built a network of its jurisdictions that would make themselves better places to attract talent, have a startup, be environmentally friendly, have better outdoor play areas, better education. My buddy's like, this is genius. This is genius, but it's the first time I ever heard of it. So I think the network that you said of the collective intelligence is both corporate and community. And maybe the Michelin thing, maybe there's more of them, and I was just clueless. But I was like, I can't wait to give the speech now because I can't wait to meet the people.
We kind of floated we floated that idea to Jérôme Lanier, who's like the chief scientist at Microsoft, and he was very much against the terms we were using and didn't really want to answer it. But what he did say was that all of this technology, he just sees it as people collaborating with people, which I think ties in nicely to kind of this core idea that we've been talking about, that a city, even a city like Detroit, where its industry can just be ripped from it, it's the people there that are still like interested in seeing each other and interacting with each other and pushing whatever their community is forward. So that seems like hopefully some sort of constant that could
emerge. And it's really interesting when you look at automotive R&D, because I did this. The electric vehicle is different. I mean, a lot of that's in the Bay Area. But if you look at a lot of the R&D related to automotive, no place touches Michigan. So you've ripped so much of the factory infrastructure out of there, but the design, the research, the innovation, it's still there. And you go, how could that be? You know, still, it would be the Bay Area. parts of Asia and Korea and China and Detroit, mm-hmm. not greater Detroit. You'd have to put Ann Arbor right. and all the surrounding communities.
Mm-hmm.
But it, there's a legacy of capability that never gets ripped out.
The
Yeah, and maybe that's that network effect. It still exists, it persists because it's because our memories persist. So we remember Detroit as that, and people continue to go there and cluster. And this kind of brings me to, in the early days of decentralization and decentralization technologies, I got really excited about it. But now I'm actually waning on it, and only waning in a sense that I think we were overly centralized, but now the pendulum swings to decentralized. And I think now I'm coming up with this concept of right centralization,
yep.
you know, and I think cities are a great place to try to find that right centralized, like what is the balance? Let's look at cities.
And so the thing that Jane Jacobs always went back to was this notion of subsidiarity and the idea that you should move decision making to the smallest, most localized unit as possible. And we know that many of the best managed companies have done, like Toyota. This was the Toyota production system. This is what they did. They took the decision making for the factory floor and took it out of the corporate suite and gave it to the factory workers. So Jane's point, and actually Alice Rivlin wrote a whole book about this when she was at Brookings, that we've put too much of our political power in the hands of a president or a finance minister or defense minister. There are certain things that have to be done at that level, but much more of the stuff like innovation, productivity, technology transfer should be done locally. So I think that's your idea of organized centralization or centralized. It has to be a system in which you push the most decision making down to the most local and you empower people to be part of it.
Right. Yeah, there's some coordination effort that still required because network effect is a thing. And so cities matter, but it's these clusters, right? It's not overly centralized. It's not overly decentralized where it's all rural. And this right centralization is tricky, right? Because it's complex. There's many factors that go into it. And as you said, which I'm still spinning on and I think is fascinating, this idea that even in the physical world, we have virtual clusters, like yeah. cities that are not physically close to each other, but are part of this network, like Austin is to San Francisco. That's a
they're
fascinating
bound by human
concept.
Relationships. Yeah.
Oh, just fascinating to me. So at the end of the day, I do think it's that the intersections are the most, like we started to talk about cities, the thing I know a little bit about. It's where the digital and the physical world meet each other that I think is really super interesting.
Yeah.
Not either as a substitute for one another. And I think so much of our world is the polarity. And I've always tried to look. Herb Simon at Carnegie Mellon always said this, don't look where other people look and always look for intersections, like disciplinary. And so I'm always trying to look for the intersections. And it seems to me with the AI, with the digital and the physical, that's the more interesting is where they connect. And I was at this talk once with one of the people inventing one of the headsets, super, super big brain, Carnegie Mellon, MIT graduate. And he was saying that he didn't see the headset as a substitute for reality. And he used the idea of sports. And he said, one of the key things I see with my goggles, and he put them on, is that if you go to a sporting event, you like all the data that you see on your TV screen, like who's scoring what are the point differentials, like, in the goggles, I can still watch the sporting event, but get all the rich data immersive thing. He's like, I see the goggles as much wearing at a live physical event as I do a substitute for that event. I thought that was a really smart point.
Yeah, that sounds like Jerome.
Yeah.
I think it might have been. It's the idea that there's no point in going to a virtual world that resembles identically the physical world. It's more exciting to go and where physics has different rules, where we get to experience things we can't versus replicating it.
And
that goes from not learning and things like that. Obviously, there's a component of practicality, but setting that aside.
Well, think about the sphere. And I haven't been, but the people I know hate Las Vegas the most have gone to it. And they went to see a concert in this immersive environment, right? That's interesting to me that it provides a new kind of concert experience, right? That you didn't get in a traditional concert hall. And you can see now a future generation of stadiums and arenas. So that's where I think it gets real. It's probably the enhancement, not the substitution. It's the enhancement of the physical.
Right, right.
The physical, whatever, the physics, the atoms. It's the bits enhancing the atoms, which is really super interesting.
Yeah, I think that bears out in at least our view of how AI technology should be applied, right? It's not it's not replacing people, it's augmenting their abilities, giving them better information, letting them make better choices.
Yeah. Well, man, this was a great conversation.
Absolutely.
I really enjoyed it.
Let's do it again.
I love
this.
For sure.
And as soon as you guys said, like, it was the nicest, you know, how you're trying to do something and schedule something, I want to make this happen. And then one of your producers says, no, they like unscripted conversation. I'm like, yes, this is exactly what I love. So thank you for having me on and thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining this ongoing conversation about conversational AI. Be sure to subscribe to Invisible Machines wherever you get your podcasts. And if you feel so inclined, please leave us a review on the Apple Podcast app. You can also watch these conversations on the Invisible Machines YouTube channel. This podcast is produced for UX Magazine in partnership with OneReach.ai. Over the past 5 years, our team of nearly 200 engineers, scientists, experienced designers, anthropologists, and linguists have been developing Generative Studio X, an award-winning platform that has the lone distinction of being named a leader by every major analyst group. GSX is a complete environment for hosting, creating, analyzing, and scaling your own digital teammates called Intelligent Digital Workers. For an interactive demo of IDWs in action and to learn more about the GSX platform, head to onereach.ai. This podcast would not be possible without the hard work and dedication of executive producer Elias Parker and producer Kate Timchenko. Our video and audio editor is Michael Litvinov, and we rely on support from the marketing team at onereach.ai, including Allison Harshberger, Anastasia Nechtalio, and Vera Prokodko. Thanks again, and we look forward to connecting with you next week, right here on Invisible Machines.